Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Kenneth Armstrong, Director of the Centre for European Legal Studies, and welcome to our exciting programme of lunchtime seminars this term. Today we kick off in great style with Federico Fabbrini. Federico is Assistant Professor of Law at Tilburg University and soon to become Associate Professor of Law at Copenhagen. So congratulations on the move. Federico works broadly in the area of EU and comparative constitutional comparative federalism, I suppose, in many ways. Been very much active in recent times on working on the economic crisis and its consequences, co-edited a book on the constitutionalization of European budgetary constraints, but particularly well known for his monograph on European fundamental rights published by Oxford University Press, which is fast becoming an absolute must-read for anybody interested in European fundamental rights and its development in the EU. Today's paper, though, takes him away from fundamental rights and back to the crisis and its consequences. And I had the great fortune to read Federico's paper, and I have to say it's probably his most provocative paper, I think, in setting out a very ambitious argument that the politics of austerity needs some form of calming influence, and one mechanism for that might be to look at where power seems to increasingly lie these days, and that's with the European Council, and particularly with the role of its president. So I will hand over now to Federico to provoke you even further. Thanks, Federico.
Thank you very much, Kenneth, for your kind introduction. It's really a great pleasure for me to be here today, and I'm particularly honored to give the first lecture in these terms, in this seminar series beginning this term. The title of my paper today is Changing Policy by Changing Institution, Austerity, Horizontal Federalism, and the Strengthening of the President of the European Council. And before I start, I should just give you sort of a little bit of the background of it. This paper is part of a book project I'm currently working on the constitutional implication of the crisis. But specifically, I was commissioned to write this work for the Indiana Journal of Global Legal Studies yearly symposium that took place in the United States about a month ago. And the focus of this year's symposium was austerity, and my American colleagues were interested in understanding why has Europe ended up being trapped in austerity. And of course, the paper tries to look at that from an institutional point of view and to, you know, raise questions about the institutional design of the European Union. Having said this, I should immediately advance a sort of a caveat. I am all the more aware, as Kenneth already said, that the paper is provocative. It's certainly raising arguments that are not that conventional. So I would be very much surprised if there were no people who disagrees with me. But I do really hope the opportunity to present the paper here and discuss with you will be enriching. And I hope at least the paper will point out to a possible direction of development in the EU institutional structure that it's meaningful in light of the current challenges we face in the European Union. So to get started, let me very briefly outline what the paper is about and what are the questions that I try to answer. So essentially, the purpose of the work is to address two questions. The first one is, why has austerity become resilient in the European Union What are the reasons that have made our continent, and notably the Eurozone, become trapped into austerity policy? And the second question, somehow immediately a follow-up on the first one, is what can we do about it? How can we change this state of affairs and bring back Europe towards a path of growth? Now, I'm not an economist, obviously, much less a political scientist, so of course my focus is on law and institutions. And in a nutshell, actually, the argument that I make in my paper is that austerity has become dominant in the European Union because of its institutional structure. In other words, there is an embedded dynamic in the institutional design of the Union which has made austerity become the dominant policy. And I will explain that this is largely a result of the rise of the European Council as the center of EU politics and the asymmetrical relationship between member states, which we have experienced since the entry into force of the Lisbon Treaty and with the crisis. Now, if this assessment is correct, if my reading of the causes of the emergence of austerity policies are plausible, then of course the second part of the paper seeks to look at what can we do about it. And obviously, if austerity is a result of institutional design, then I think we need to seriously consider the question of constitutional change as a way forward for the European Union. And in particular, as the subtitle of my paper suggests, I am making the case in favor of strengthening the presidency of the European Council as a possible way out of the trap in which Europe has ended up, and as a institutional device to create space for democratic debate and contestation on the policies of the Union. So let me give you the plan de l'exposé, as the French call it, just a very brief outline of the structure of the paper, and related to that, the structure of my talk. And by the way, I should thank Felicity of the Center of European Legal Studies, because she has printed a number of copies of the papers, and they are available here for those of you who are interested. And of course, feel free to email me if you also would like to get the paper. But basically, the paper is structured in five parts. The first one looks at the rise of the European Council as the most important institution in setting the policy agenda of the Union. And at the same time, it explains how in the intergovernmental context of the European Council, the balance, the equilibrium between the state has been upset, with some states, notably Germany, because of its size and economic might, coming to play a hegemonic role. And I think austerity, as I will try to point out, is really the outcome of this situation. Now, in light of that, in the second part of the paper, I move on to the more prospective discussion of a possible way forwards, and I outline alternative views that have been framed recently in the scholarship and by policymakers. But then I suggest that actually the idea of strengthening the president of the European Council might be one of the most convincing option on the table, and not only because this idea was already discussed at the time of the European Constitutional Convention about 10 years ago, but also because of a number of features of the EU institutional system that makes this hypothesis more plausible. And then, of course, because, as I already said, this is a fairly, definitely not a straightforward idea, much of the paper is focused on discussing the huge constitutional challenges that would be associated with the option of strengthening the presidency of the European Council. And in particular, I have a section that discusses the question of power and representation. How can we frame the power of the presidency? Another section which discusses the key question of election. How can we make sure that a more democratic presidency is responsive to the people? And of course, the final point, we are lawyers, we are realists. How can we make sure the treaties can be changed? Because there's no way out of the conundrum that you need unanimous consents of the member states to get any proposal of institutional reform of this caliber out. So, of course, I'm not going to go in any of these last 3 points in detail. There won't be time for it. I'll probably say something on point five, but I hope this will give you a sort of more comprehensive view of how the paper is developing and what are its components. So let me get started in looking a little bit more in detail at the institutional transformation that we have experienced in the European Union since the entry of the into force of the Lisbon Treaty in 2009, and at the very same time, since the beginning of the euro crisis. Interestingly enough, the two events were almost overlapping. And I don't know whether there are American students in the room or people familiar with U.S. law generally, but in case this, if this is the case, of, I'm sure they will have immediately spotted the fact that the title of this slide, Accident Force, it's an expression I'm drawing from Federalist Papers number 1, written by Alexander Hamilton, which used to speak of constitution based on accident and force. Now, I think the constitution, the institutional, the form of government of the EU that we currently have now is the result of accident and force. I think very few observers at the time of the ratification of the Treaty of Lisbon had realized the importance that the European Council would come to play in European policymaking. But nowadays, I think it's almost uncontested to say that the European Council has become the most important EU institution. Political scientists, which like to look at reality more than lawyers, have noticed that. There is a book recently out by Uwe Ploeter dedicated to European Council, which makes the case, I think, in a very convincing way for the rise of the European Council. Now, the irony of things is that, as you know, the European Council is the body that groups the heads of state and government of the member state. And in theory, it's the body that better represents the equality between the member states. Every country has one person that represents it at the negotiating table. Whether you are Malta or whether you are Germany, someone will speak for you at the table of the European Council. Now, the reality is that within the European Council, as it's often the case within intergovernmental institutions, states are not equal. Sources of power matters enormously. And larger states usually have much larger leeway in the decision-making process. And it is therefore not really surprising to notice that in the functioning of the European Council, larger states, and notably Germany, have come to play a dominating role. Of course, this is something that in the press is nowadays very much emphasized, but it does reflect a reality. And I think the policy of austerity that we have seen in Europe since the beginning of the crisis has been promoted as the main answer to the crisis really reflected and still reflects the dominant position of Germany within the functioning of the European Council. And you can see that because, on the one hand, of course, the idea of austerity, budgetary constraint, and a number of other economic ideas which have been promoted since the beginning of the crisis are really consistent with the long-term German approach to the economy. That's a so-called ordo-liberal theory of economics that, as you know, have been extremely influential in the reconstruction of Germany after World War II, and it's really embedded in the way the German political elites sees the economy. So, of course, promoting austerity was consistent with that view. At the same time, of course, promoting austerity was also very much consistent with the short-term interest of Germany in protecting its banks. I cannot enter into the details here, but you all know that the treaty technically enshrined a no bailout clause. Once Greece was on the brink of default, you know, a number of people said, well, we should really enforce the treaty and let Greece go bust. But of course, the effect of that measures would have been terrible for German banks, which were heavily exposed vis-a-vis Greek bonds. So of course, bailing out Greece and imposing harsh austerity measure on the country, while at the same time securing the solvency of German banks, was no surprise of interest for Germany. Now, I will not enter here, there's definitely no time to do this, into a discussion whether austerity is good or bad. I think economies are probably better placed than us to do this. But what I want to point out is that regardless of the inherent merit of austerity policies, there is no doubt that austerity has come under fire from multiple member states in Europe. If you look at election results from 2011 onwards, basically the majority of EU member states have installed government which were against austerity policy, starting with France with the election of François Hollande, going to Italy, my home state, with the election of the Democratic Party. And of course, huge protests have occurred from Madrid to Lisbon to Athens against austerity policy. Yet this has changed nothing. And that's, to me, something that is really interesting. How is it possible that the policy of austerity has been so much criticized through the ballot box and in the squares of European towns, and yet it has remained there as the key policy answer by the European Union to the crisis? And again, I think the answer here has to do with the way in which decisions are taken in the European at the European level, with the rise of the European Council. Once again, because in the European Council, states matters, and more powerful states matter more, you can't change your national government, but you can't change what the European Council decides as the policy of the Union. Now, the other very interesting thing is that even EU Parliament elections have changed nothing. And that's, I think, a very important point, because the Spitzenkandidaten game, and I'm sure most of you are familiar with it, had unleashed a number of ill-fated, I can say now, expectation that the parliamentarization of the Commission would bring back the center of politics in the relationship between the Parliament and the Commission, and therefore create there a space for contestation on the policies of the Union. But what we have seen so far is that il faut que tout change parce que ne change pas. Everything must change for nothing to change. The European Council remains at the helm. The European Commission reflects the desires of the European Council. And austerity remains still now the leading strategy of the Union to come out of the crisis. Now, if my assessment of the causes of austerity in Europe is correct, if my institutional reading of the situation is reasonable, then of course I think we need to open the debate about institutional reform in the Union as the instrument to reopen a debate about economic policies in the Union. And here I move on to my perspective part of the paper, and again the title here, Reflection and Choice, is taken by the very same paper by Alexander Hamilton, Federalist Paper Number 1, where he said, we have constitutions which are the result of accident and force, but, you know, we could also have constitutions which are the result of reflection and choice. We can think about institutional design critically and devise structures that better reflect our needs. And to be very explicit here, basically, the question I try to address in this part of the paper is, if the European Council is so central in policy making within the European Union, how can we make sure that its decisions are not captured by hegemonic influence of one state? I think that's the key point we have to address now, and I'm putting it out there in a very, you know, non-politically correct way. Fine. But I think that's the issue. Now, I think there are alternative answers to that. Many people still place a lot of faith into the parliamentarization process in the Union. So they acknowledge that the May 2014 election have not really been the watermark moment many were expecting, but maybe in 2019 things will change. Other people, notably a former president of the European Commission, said, well, if one country is hegemonic in the Council, let's build up an alliance of other countries which can, you know, counterbalance this agenda. I don't really like such ideas. We are celebrating 100 years of World War I. Hegemonic policy should be out of the table, in my view, in Europe. And here comes, therefore, my proposal. if the council is really so central, why don't we think of ways to make the presidency of the council more legitimate, more effective, and at the same time, more autonomous from the states in setting the policy strategy for the union? As you all know, the Lisbon Treaty marked an important step in this regard because for the first time, it separated the institution of the presidency of the European Council from the presidency of the Council, which rotates every 6 months between the states. The Lisbon Treaty creates a new figure, a semi-permanent president elected for 2.5 years and renewable once, which has to lead the Council. Now, at the time of the Constitutional Convention, I was saying this before, actually proposals were made to endow the presidency with greater powers and legitimacy. Ironically, the smaller member states refused that, as they thought it would be a step too far away. Well, what we have seen, however, is that a weaker presidency has actually worked, I think, to their disadvantage. In its current format, the president of the European Council is selected by the head of state and government, which basically means he's only responsible to them. And of course, he has very limited power. He's basically a chairman, although I still think Van Rompuy did make inroads in consolidating the role of the position and the institution. Nevertheless, I think we really need to take further steps in the direction of endowing the presidency, on the one hand, with greater power, and on the other hand, of greater legitimacy. And of course, what I mean by power and legitimacy here is capacity to set the agenda of the European Union outside the constraints that comes from the heads of state and government and the most powerful among them. And immediately related to this, in the moment which we create a strong power at the European level, we need to make sure this power is legitimized. And that's why I'm suggesting we should think of introducing forms of democratic election of the presidency of the European Council. And again, ironically, this is something that was discussed at the time of the Constitutional Convention. And of course, again, the proposal is obviously controversial, but there's one distinctive advantage of it that I consider really important, which is the capacity of a strongly legitimated president to keep the states under check. The president should control the states rather than be the puppets of the states. And at the same time, precisely because we see such a symmetry in the European Council, and so precisely because the interests of the member states are diverging so much, having one figure at the European level which can summarize and, you know, create a synthesis of the possible interest which exist in the Union and thus open up the space for democratic contestation would be, I think, a step forward for our form of governance. Now, this is, in a nutshell, the core institutional proposal I'm making, and I should now move on to mention what are some of the challenges that obviously would emerge if we were to follow this prospect of institutional change. A first obvious problem is what exactly should the power of the presidency be? And ironically, Kenneth said this, I have a background of comparative constitutional lawyers, and what I can tell you is that constitutions around the world hardly ever define what the powers of the executive should be. So that's a big challenge for us. Of course, a strong presidency in a union like the European Union should not have undefined power. That would be a threat. There's no doubt about it. So we would have to be very clear in making clear and probably making explicit in the text what are these powers. And for instance, I recommend that the president should remain strictly separated from parliament. So we should constitutionalize a system of separation of powers rather than a system of fusion of powers. And at the same time, I advise that the president be given direct power of appointment of the commissioners, which is something that obviously is very much contested and contestable. But if the commission is really the machine that runs the union, we need to give it democratic perfectly legitimated head. Now, the second point, of course, and that's another big challenge, is how do you make sure, if you want to really democratize the institution of the presidency, what electoral, you know, mechanism can you invent to introduce the election of the presidency while at the same time featuring the huge differences in the size between the member states. Now, the Union, European Union, is a union in where four member states account for more than 50% of the EU population. So you can't really think of any direct election, because obviously these states would be the kingmakers, and the other 24 member states of the Union would count nothing. So in the paper, I go a little bit in detail here. I discuss comparative experience, and I essentially claim that we should think something in the logic of the US Electoral College, but with important differences. The basic idea here is that you need to devise a mechanism which slightly overrepresents small states, so that gives them an interest in being part of a constitutional endeavor of this size. And of course, we can come back to this in the Q&A session if you're interested, but I don't want to go into the detail. Rather, let me say some final things maybe on the third challenge, which is what I call the feasibility challenge. And obviously, the bottom line when discussing this part is that you need to change the treaty. There's no way out about this. You can't use enhanced cooperation. You can't do anything through old-fashioned international law. If you want to have an institutional reform of this size in the Union, you need to change the treaty. And as you know, treaty requires unanimity. So, of course, the most skeptical observers of my argument will say, well, you're just crazy, Federico. Why are you even thinking about this? Yet, I tend to be an optimist in life, fair enough. And I also think there are a number of developments that actually make the possibility of treaty change more likely than what we might thought. The first one is the fact that the treaties have been recently subject to revisions. Since Maastricht, we have changed the treaty 4 times. Plus, of course, as you know, in response to the euro crisis, the member states have repeatedly signaled their interest in changing the constitutional architecture of the Union whenever this was necessary. The Treaty on the European Stability Mechanism was adopted, the Fiscal Compact, recently the Agreement on the Transfer and Mutualization of Contribution to the Single Resolution Fund in the context of the Banking Union. So the states can do this if they want to. And at the same time, there is a window of opportunity, and I think that's something very interesting, which is opened precisely by the Fiscal Compact. Because as I'm sure most of you know, Article 16 of the Fiscal Compact requires the member states to reincorporate the content of the Fiscal Compact within the Treaty on the European Union by 2019. And there are a number of provisions of the Fiscal Compact, including the provision relating to the Euro Summit, the gathering of the head of state and government of the Eurozone countries, which will definitely require treaty changes in the TEU and the TFEU. So that offers a window of opportunity for discussing the possibility of institutional reform in the direction of strengthening the presidency of the Council in the coming year. And of course, in the paper, I also discuss from a more policy perspective, what would be the interest for the states for that? And I make the case that actually the smaller states would gain in influence, the southern states would gain in credibility, the eastern state would gain in security. And since I am in the UK, let me also say that probably the UK would gain in voice. The UK is a big state, but it counts nothing in EU decision-making process. And I'm sure I'm not shocking anyone by saying it. But of course, if you had a presidency directly elected, you couldn't marginalize such a major important member state as you can do now. And of course, this leaves out one country, which is Germany. And I'm looking, of course, at Marcus, he will forgive me. But, get out.
I just live here.
Of course, Germany would lose from the institutional solution I propose, because currently it's the country that calls the shot in the Council, in the European Council. Yet I do think Germany has a long-term interest in preventing, a public opinion slides that perceives the Union as being again dominated by Germany. So when German flags are burned in Syntagma Square, or when a former president of the European Commission says that France, Italy, and Spain should make a coalition against Germany, well, Germany should be afraid. And of course, making a step back and recognizing the space for institutional reform would be, I think, it's in its long-term interest. And at the same time, I do think Germany should receive paybacks for this step. Constitution making is always the result of compromise. Everyone should get something out of it. I, for instance, am very, very critical of any idea about Eurobonds. No federal system worldwide requires one unit of government to pay for the debts of other units of government. So why should Germany bear the burden of Italian or Greek debt? I think this should be totally outlawed in the treaty, and I think this could be a reasonable payback. And again, here we might just be, you know, imagined. It's a very far away idea, perhaps, but I think it's something to be discussed, that in the moment we devise a package of treaty changes that should buy all the states in. So I guess my time is running out, and I'm sure most of you are by now thinking that this guy who was invited at Cambridge is just crazy. But let me tell you this as a conclusive part of my talk. We are really facing an unsustainable situation in Europe. No growth, in fact, probably negative growth. No inflation, in fact, probably staggering deflation. And of course, skyrocketing unemployment. And you know, I'm 29 years old, I see my friends that don't work. And I don't think any political community can survive in the long term in this condition. So you may not like my idea, that's fine, but I think we need to discuss new ideas here. The time has come for fresh views on how the Union should develop. We can't recycle the old wine, I believe. And if I can conclude here with a comparative note, much of my work is inspired by looking at the experience of the United States. I think the situation we are facing in Europe today shows remarkable parallels with the Great Depression in the United States in the 1930s. And of course, as you all know, the United States came out from the Great Depression through the New Deal because of the presidency. Up to that point, the executive office of the United States played an almost insignificant role. It was Congress, the main institution, but Congress could not deliver on this issue. And it has been the transformative power of the presidency that has changed course in America and has offered a fantastic forum for contestation and discussion about economic policy of the United States. So again, I'm not convinced I've convinced any one of you, but I do think that if we want to see Europe change its course and find a new deal of growth, I think we have to reopen again the institutional question. And it's a Pandora box. It creates a lot of troubles, but I'm afraid we'll have to do it. Thank you very much.